This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off. Bill Perkins is an American hedge fund manager, film producer, and high-stakes poker player from Houston, Texas. He specifically focuses on venture capital and energy markets. In this conversation, we discuss the energy markets, universal basic income, how investing is a psychology test, why Bill plays such high-stakes poker, and what the big idea behind his new book, Die with Zero, really means. I enjoyed this conversation with Bill, and I think you guys will as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. The first is BlockFi. As many of you already know, I'm a huge fan of the company. I'm an investor and a user. Today, they offer three products. The first is giving US dollar loans against your crypto as collateral. The second is an interest-bearing account for your crypto deposits where you can earn up to 8.6% APY. And the third is allowing you to buy or trade cryptocurrencies. These three products are important in helping people do more with their Bitcoin, Ethereum, or stable coins. You gotta check it out. As if these products weren't enough, BlockFi also recently told their users they'll be launching a credit card in 2020 that pays their rewards in Bitcoin rather than cashback or loyalty points. A Bitcoin rewards credit card not only sounds dope, but should help more people earn Bitcoin for their everyday purchases too. BlockFi's been a longtime supporter of this podcast, and I'm a huge fan, so go to BlockFi.com/pomp to check them out. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp, and there may even be some discounts and surprises when you head on over to BlockFi.com/pomp, so go check it out. Also, don't forget, I write a daily letter to over 45,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy-to-understand language while sharing opinions on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com, pompletter.com, or go click the link in the description. All right, let's get into this episode with Bill. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I have Bill here with us. As I was joking with him, he is sitting on a boat in beautiful blue waters, and I'm sitting in New York City trying not to get COVID-19. So thanks for doing it.
Both have the same goals, just different locations.
Absolutely. For those that don't know you, let's just start with your background and kind of where you grew up and then how you got into finance.
Okay, so I grew up in Jersey City, New Jersey. I went to school in the University of Iowa. And right around my fourth year, I'm a five-year graduate, my godfather goes, you know, basically gives me the what the hell are you going to do with your life kind of talk, which I was kind of delusional. You know, I knew I didn't want to do engineering. I went to school for electrical engineering. But I knew I wanted to make money, and I saw the movie Wall Street, and I thought, this is a way to like leverage my time and make a bunch of money. So I said, I want to go into stocks. He's like, I don't know anything about stocks, but I know this commodity firm on the exchange floor. Do you want to go take a visit, bring your resume, et cetera, take a visit? So long story short, I show up my resume. They take my resume. They tear it up. They throw it on the ground. You don't need that here. They walk me around. And I thought I had a job. I didn't have the job. Like there was apparently somebody else vying for the job. So I used to come down to the exchange for 3 days waiting. Like, can I get a job? Calling, can I get a job? Can I get in? Waiting downstairs to get hired. And I finally got hired as a peon, like assistant peon. And, you know, I worked my way up from there.
Yeah. And so when you first got started, did you go right into the energy market or were you doing something else?
So I worked for a company called Refine Energy that was in the crude oil. Back then, there was only crude oil, gasoline, right? Those pits where they were at, and heating oil, diesel. And so I was a screen clerk for that firm. That's where I started, right? And that's where I started learning about commodities and options, et cetera, working at different firms on the floor.
Yeah. And I guess one of the big leaps I think that every trader wants to make is I want to go from working for somebody else to eventually starting my own stuff. And kind of what was that transition like? Because you were at a couple of different places and then eventually went out on your own. But kind of what drove that?
that was like a, there was a meandering process, right? Like I needed to learn, I needed to stumble. I was in brokering over the counter, which I hated, although it was lucrative, but I really hated it. And then I got offered to run an options desk in Houston as they were deregulating natural gas and needed traders to basically manage risk. And so I swore I would never go to Texas. Like leaving the Upper West Side to go to Texas was like, friends were like, what the hell are you doing? But I would have went to Siberia to trade. You know, I really, really wanted to be a trader. I really wanted to be a master of my own fate. I really wanted to eat what I killed, not dependent on people's moods, but dependent on my ability versus the markets. And so I left, and through a long process, you know, developed a name for myself, either good or bad, right? And worked with, eventually when Enron went under, my friend John Arnold was going to start his fund. And I was like, well, if you pay me this percent, I'll come work with you. You know, we're just two young guys trying to take on the world. And we started off four people in Centaurus, starting this natural gas trading shop. And then that firm became, you know, long story short, the most successful commodity hedge fund ever, aside from Rensselaer, in commodity trading, right? Just a ridiculous run. He called in rich and retired, and then I started my own fund.
Got it. And when you guys started that, was it something where you were managing personal capital at that point? Was it you had a couple LPs and that really gave the confidence to make the jump? Or did you guys start and then have to go raise the money before you could actually start trading?
So one of the craziest things about Centaurus, as successful it was, is that I didn't have a dime of my own money in the fund, which the logic at the time, which I now know is totally false, was that, listen, it's okay to have no money and a job, or a lot of money and no job, but no job and no money is pretty bad. And so the idea was, if we blow up and you have your money in here, you know, that's a bad thing. And so we didn't do it. But, you know, looking back, I was so young, I was like, I could easily recover from this. I should have taken the risk, right? And so John started Centaurus with $8 million of his own money. And the investors that said they were going to put the money in day one, they didn't show up. But after we posted a 170 or whatever, 300% return, they started knocking on the door, right? And then, you know, the next year, whatever, and they kept knocking on the door to the point where it got to the point where John was kicking people out and not letting people in. Like he was able to get to the point where he was able to choose the partner he wanted in.
I asked a very well-known hedge fund manager, I said, how do you guys raise so much money? And he said, we don't. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, we don't do shit. The returns raise the money, right? Just people come and find us because they want the returns.
Right. It's very path dependent too. It's unfortunate because, you know, no one bats 1,000. A lot of people have, you know, bad year or whatever. A good thesis, great bet, would do it 100 times out of 100. But if you have that bad stub year or that bad first year, you just, it's almost impossible to raise money, right? And so that's the bad side about raising outside capital, you know?
For sure. And then talk a little bit about when you actually went out on your own, kind of why go out on your own, and what were some of the things you learned as you did that?
I thought, you know, that I was avoiding FOMO partially, right? When Centaurus stopped, Greg Whaley, who now runs Copperwood, and I were going to partner together. Right. I being the second most successful trader at Copperwood, and a bunch of other all-stars, they're all all-stars at Copperwood. You know, he was going to start the fund. And the bottom line is Greg and I could not agree on control, risk limits, et cetera. Right. Like Greg's a military guy. There can only be one captain. Right. And so even though we're great friends and we still talk a lot, it was better for me to go away. And the reason why is the pooling risk in commodities. You know, guys wanted me to stay for, you know, having my set of neurons and my way of thinking to help the fund. But I was like, listen, you could have your best year ever and I could wipe you out, right? Because if I have a bad year, I trade such a big, you know, big book, big style. You kind of want to be insulated from that. You think you want me, but you don't want me. You know, and we can always talk shop, right? So you still get my neurons, right? But you don't have the risk. And so that's the way it went.
Got it. And then when you went out on your own, you went right to all the energy stuff, or were you trading other commodities as well?
No, it's just to trade what I know, right? Like, it would be hard. It would be very, very hard pressed for me to raise money outside of, you know, what I had been doing then. It's pulling teeth raising money. So we were able to get, you know, a big check from one institutional investor, a fund of funds, and we're still a small, teeny fund, but, and a couple other friends and family and high net worth individuals.
For sure. And then as you've grown, I think you're also doing venture capital investing now as well a little bit.
Yeah, I do that through my own entity, right? I have enough capital to be like, I guess, a medium-sized family office. And so I have a lot of in-house expertise that I've hired over the years to attack certain problems, deal with certain issues. And so I have a CIO, I have, you know, capital to deploy, and I love solving puzzles. So I've been doing that kind of on the side, but it's not on the side at the size we're doing it. You know, I say it on the side because my primary job is trading natural gas and trading energy, but, you know, we rewrite what I would consider somewhat significant tickets. You know, when I go into, you know, a publicly listed stock and I look at how many shares I hold, and I'm like, oh wow, we're in the top. If they listed us, we'd be in the top 10, right, of shares, you know. And so, and when we come into a private placement, you know, we're able to write the tickets that people are looking for and the sizes, right? They don't want one single investor to control it, but they're looking for half a million, 2 million to 5 million blocks. You know, we're able to write that ticket. So it's gotten pretty serious, you know, it's always serious, right? But it's significant. The unfortunate thing is though, we do have a limited pool of capital and there's lots of great things to go look at and you want to play.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the energy natural gas world. Obviously, things have been absolutely chaotic, to say the least. Kind of, what are you seeing in the market, and how are you guys thinking about what's going to transpire here coming in the future?
Right. Like the two things that we're kind of is the demand destruction going on from response to COVID-19 versus supply destruction from crude oil shut-ins and rigs being dropped, right? And so we have these opposing forces happening, right? And it's chaotic, right? Like people, we're looking at like power burns and supply getting turned back from LNG versus shut-ins versus nobody's doing anything, right? And, you know, our general thesis right now is that we used to be extremely bearish the front of the curve, but we've tempered that because of the rig count and shut-ins and prices, right? Nothing cures high prices better than high prices, and nothing cures a glut better than a glut, right? And so those play, you know, the problem with our view is that there's a lot, normally we're very, like our error rate, right, we'll say is a half a BCF a day. If anybody knows, that's a billion cubic feet a day. For example, the United States is producing about 93 BCF a day, right? So that's where we want to be in our error rate. Like now our error rate's like 2 BCF a day, 3. Like it's very hard to pinpoint a single variable. How much is production going to be from May within 2 BCF a day? How much is demand destruction right now within a BCF a day? I don't know, you know, and what will it be in the future? Those are very hard to predict. But if you have an overwhelming cumulative factor like supply declines, we believe as time goes on, at this low of a rig count, the supply decline will overwhelm all other factors as we get further out. Right. And so we have this kind of like very nuanced view of the world as time moves forward.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't know too many people who I've heard say that before. So maybe describe, like, explain that a little bit more as to what you mean exactly by that.
Yeah. Let me, I guess if you had a, I love, bathtub analogies, but this is, if you had a bathtub, right, and it's about to overflow, right, and you're like, oh my gosh, there's nobody using this water, it's flowing into, nobody's drinking it, it's all flowing into this tub, and this tub is going to overflow, and the drains are this big, right? And then at the same time, you're like, the drain gets a little bigger, and the flow keeps going down, 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 until there's no flow, right? So in the short term, maybe some spills over the sides, and we have a price crash, right? But over the long term, we can see the water's going to stop, and the drain is still there, right? And it's going to get very, you know, it's going to be very bullish water, right? Like, where's the water, right? And so that's the way it is in natural gas, is that the faucet of natural gas is slowing down, and the drain is staying the same or maybe getting a little bigger. And so how that plays out over time is complex, right? Like, will it overflow before, you know what I mean? Like, is it going to overflow in the short term or not? Or is it going to just be okay, right? And then as we get into the high demand periods of natural gas, which is really the winter, and as we go further in time, you know, we need to start worrying about running out of water, right? There's no water in the tub, right? And so that's kind of, I hope that analogy helps, but that's kind of the way we're looking at the market right now, is what is the overwhelming long-term variable and what's going to happen in the short term?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess how much of that are you focused just on the United States versus a lot of the things that are going internationally with Saudi, Russia, and kind of a lot of the stuff that they're trying to manipulate?
You know, over time, you know, the U.S. used to import natural gas. It still does in Everett, right, up in Boston. But over the years, we've gone from importing to exporting 7.5, going up to 8 to 10 BCF a day, right? So that's a significant number. So that has forced every single natural gas trader to pay attention to what's going on in the world. We used to love our market because it was a niche market that was complex enough that the average person couldn't figure it out. But you could if you built a fund and built in resources, right? There weren't that many variables. And now there's this extra variable of what's happening internationally. Are they going to basically turn back all the LNG that we're shipping to them, thus complicating our situation here? So we're very much aware of, you know, we build AI ship models and tracking models of the fundamentals in Europe, and also try and figure out what's going on in Asia and that black box, tracking ships, et cetera, because we need to know, okay, when Europe says, when the price of European gas goes below U.S. gas, as it is right now, we need to know how many cargoes are going to wind up at our doorstep, thus putting pressure on the price, right? And so we've all been forced to go to school very quickly on international markets.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I guess as part of this, like, what would change your mind about the thesis on where natural gas is going now? Are there certain things that you guys are looking at as either kind of flags or things that you're like, hey, if X happens, then we would actually change our thesis?
Yeah, I mean, we're concerned about the level of, like, you know, most of these things are highly educated guesses, right? So, you know, I've gone from bearish to front to mildly supportive, right? With massive error, right, baked in there. And, you know, I would look at, okay, we're measuring the supply every day. And is it declining at the rate, right? And that's one of those slow boiling frogs you don't know because it's noisy. You have to get a bunch of data. We're looking at how quickly the U.S. opens or doesn't open up. Is it going to keep opening and shutting up, right, with affecting the demand equation? We're looking at international prices, like what's going to happen with these LNG ships and these turnbacks, right? We have a count and media reports, but it could be bigger, right? We could say, looks like it's 2.5 Bs a day, but what if it's 5, right? And so these things are things that in the short term we're watching. For the long term, the biggest thing is rig count. If you don't have rigs drilling, you can't overcome the declines. So I think, I don't know if people know this, but when you drill a natural gas well, you have this high production and then it starts to decline pretty steep, right? And so we have to find 18, I think it's 18 BCF a day, 16, 18 BCF a day, I don't have the number exact, just to stem declines, right? So we need rigs out there running just so it doesn't decline. And so when you take the rigs down more than 50%, which we've done, in 3 weeks. It's just amazing how much we've stopped drilling and stopped frac crews going out producing gas. That over time becomes just an overwhelming factor. So the main thing I look at every day is what are rig counts doing, you know? And then I do further research, how long does it take rig counts to go up versus down, right? Because it's easy to drop a rig, we're dropping rigs. How long does it take to get the crew back out, back on the pad, et cetera, and then grow it? And so every day that I see the rig count drop and stay at this level, the more bullish I become the back.
How much of the rigs going down is driven by like COVID-19 social distancing stuff versus the economy and actual prices dropping, and so then it becomes unprofitable?
I think it's 99.9% prices, a response to prices and what's going on in oil. So we have a lot of the natural gas produced here is produced by associated gas. Basically, you're drilling for oil and gas comes out with it, right? And so the oil is a higher priced product and gas is kind of the byproduct, right? To the extent that, you know, they're flaring gas in the Permian and Bakken, right? And they're selling these liquids. Well, lo and behold, oil goes to crap. You know, you don't get that free byproduct of gas flowing, right? And also, so you have a lot of those rigs dropping, right? And a lot of balance sheets impaired by companies that drill both for natural gas and oil. And so they're dropping rigs, right? They have to get them, they have to lower the budgets, they have to survive, they have to tighten their belts, et cetera. And so that activity, that's what's driving, you know, the dropping of the rigs. COVID is the indirect cause, right? Because there's no demand.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess part of this is just like you're trying to calculate, you know, how quickly can you get the crews back out and get the rigs back up and running? There's also this calculation of like, they can say the cities are open or the states are open, but actually how long does it take for consumers to start, demanding or consuming, right? And I haven't got that answer yet.
Yeah, and we can measure real-time demand, right? Like, so we were able to measure real-time electricity demand, real-time, you know, we can see power burns every day, every minute. So we're tracking the demand pretty well, right? It's hard to forecast, like it can it get worse, but we're tracking it pretty well and have a reasonable idea of what the bottom is, right? New York City's completely shut down, but it's the power demand is down 11%. So we kind of know, right? So the main thing right now is like, okay, when does this faucet become a problem? Right. When does the supply issue become a problem? Right now, it's not a problem. Not a problem at all. As a matter of fact, it's the exact opposite. We have too much gas. But that switch is going to flip. And when it flips, given the current circumstances, if we stay on this path, it could be violent to the upside.
Yeah. And so what it sounds like you're really kind of highlighting here is right now you've got a surplus from a supply side, demand has gone down a little bit, but because you realize you've got the surplus and demand's down, people are actually shutting down production, incoming supply is almost slowing. And so when that demand comes flying back, there could be a moment in time where people are caught without enough supply, and that's where the problem would come in?
Yeah, like people are just cutting their production and associated production. So, you know, these guys, you know, also the cost, the break-even cost on a well has changed, right? If you look at the interest costs, drilling is a leveraged business, right? And, you know, there's been studies done in the Marcellus, like what are the break-evens at different interest rates? But if you look at like the cost of capital for the drillers, they basically have doubled on average. So I don't know if the price break-evens, you know, get you what you want, the supply you want. And so that's another thing I'm looking at. But generally right now, you know, I say there's things like there's tweezer trades where you have to be really accurate and really nuanced and know every single little detail. And there's sledgehammer trades. Huge macro thing is happening. You don't need all the details. You have enough room for error. You just pile it, right? And I think the further we get in time, this goes from tweezers to sledgehammer, right?
For sure. Let's switch gears a little bit. You not only spent a lot of time, obviously, paying attention to the markets and trading, but you also play a lot of poker. And kind of where did that fascination come from? And really, it looks like you just enjoy it. It's like, when did you kind of get into poker?
I think I got into poker or any kind of wagering on the floor, right? It's a very, locals and traders around, it's a very degenerate type attitude, right? Like, they're playing the house generally, but that feeling, that emotion of like taking risk, the risk takers. And so I have that gene, that risk taking gene, that degeneracy. And I just kind of got into that, of being able to let go and take risks, right? And be able to get lucky. And then as the stakes got higher and the money, I was like, wait a minute, I need to stop trying to get lucky and actually try and be the house just a little bit and learn poker and just get a little bit better. But I do love poker because you play with very interesting people. It's a social game, right? It's a competitive social game that you use your math skills and your cunning and intellect, but you're also interacting with some very, very interesting people. You get to meet some interesting people and characters playing poker.
For sure. And I guess as part of that, like, at what point did you make the switch from probably playing like games with friends and more kind of what I'll call the amateur levels to consciously saying, hey, I want to go play in the bigger games. I want to go play in the tournaments, whether they're public, publicly available or private. Like what was that kind of ambition?
I think it's the same delusion I had as being a trader, right? Like, it's totally delusional, right? To go, I'm going to be this multimillionaire trader and I'm going to go to Wall Street and I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. I like happen to do it, right? I'm geared to do it. I have, slightly elevated chance of being successful, but I don't think I'm that special, right? I just think that I have that motivation and a delusion. Like, you got to have that delusion to try. And so I think I had that delusion in the beginning. Like, I want to try. I could be that guy. I could beat this guy. I could win a lot of money. I could win a tournament. How hard can it be? Type of thing, And, through the school of hard knocks, you figure out it's very hard. But if you're persistent, you can get better and better and better and better. It's like a game of golf. You're always getting better, right? You can always study and be better.
For sure. What's your favorite game that you've ever played?
In terms of like no limit hold'em or like on, I think like the televised, we used to play this game where it was called not the wild card, but they would have these televised things where they would bring somebody in and give them a chance to play against sharks, right? And you'd sit there and they got to keep the money they won. And I really love that concept, and I really love playing on the shows, and I it changed people's lives. I really love those televised poker shows where people who wouldn't have the means to play in those games get a chance and keep the money. One, it's great for the game, brings out awareness, and two, I just love rooting for the underdog.
I love that. And it also brings in the whole element of there's everybody out there thinks they can beat the people on TV, right? Whether it's basketball, poker, or anything else. And so give them a shot. Yeah. See what they can do.
Yeah. Yeah. The only one where people just will not go do that is in boxing. they just know they will get their ass kicked, right? But like I say, it's like, they still write the checks whether you get your ass kicked or not. So
When we were kids, we used to joke all the time and say, how much money would it take for you to stand in the ring with Mike Tyson for 30 seconds? Or not even fight back, just for 30 seconds. How much money would it take?
Yeah, yeah. That's one of those punches that are pretty severe,
Absolutely. One of the most asked questions that I had people, no one really wanted to tweet it. They were all like DMing me this, was they said, ask Bill to tell the wildest poker story that he can that he's never told before. I said, well, I don't really know how I'm going to ask them that other than just flat out ask them. So you got any wild stories you've never told before?
Wild stories? I can't because my kids might see this. I can't. I mean, there's a story I want to tell.
It involves me. Can you make it PG?
I mean, oh, it involves me, Dan Bilzerian, Sam McGee, a bunch of interesting ladies, and at his house late at night. And I just can't. I can't do it. But I guess let me give you the second one. I mean, the other wild ones are really just money swings for people just doing ludicrous things, right? Like, just, you know, sitting out all in, 3-6 off, you know, shipping it in 200,000. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, I'm clearly not rich enough, you know, like that type of thing. But the true story would have to be, my daughters will have to be a little bit older before I tell that.
All right, that's fair enough. Fair enough. As you kind of think about investing on the venture capital side, also a couple people were interested. You know, poker is you're playing a multifaceted game, right? It's not just the math of the cards. You also are making decisions without all the information. You're playing off of other people at the table, and it's very similar to venture capital investing, where you've got to make those decisions without all the information. You got to have some confidence. You got to have some probability understanding. Like, what are some of the lessons that you've learned from poker that you've brought over on the investing side that that you think would be helpful for others?
I think that bankroll management is very important for, like, in the professional poker space. Risk, you know what I mean? You know, they're very similar, right, in terms of risk reward, limited information. You know, sometimes, you know, the market can be, you know, it's when you put on a position in the market, it's not like, oh, I'm right, I did all my homework, and then the trade goes my way, right? There's Mr. Market who goes, oh, no, we're going to be idiots and jam it up in your face, or, you know, make this trade riskier for you. You know what I mean? So you got kings and a guy's jamming all the time. You're like, does he have aces this time? Right? You know, limited information. And you just have to probability weight things, risk management, budget management, bankroll management, all these things go back and forth. And I always say it's easier for a poker player to become like a VC or a commodities trader than a commodities trader or a VC to become a poker player.
Explain that more. Why do you think that?
I just think that the school of hard knocks in poker, in terms of bankroll management, managing your risk, managing your emotions, is the main thing. Like, when people say, you know, at trading, what does it take to be a trader? I said, at the highest level, it's a psychology test, right? Because nothing changes. You just react to the market. And it's like, do you do the right thing? You know, are you thinking correctly? Are you making the right risk reward decisions? Or when you have a bad day, are you chasing? Are you doing something other than just what math, risk management, and fundamentals tell you to do, right? Are you making excuses? And, you know, poker trains you not to be results oriented, not to, you know, go on tilt, right? Not to act out of boredom or et cetera. It's all about the money, et cetera. And those skill sets translate well into trading, right? You're going to carry that over because it's your own role and you've been dealing with that. As a trader, you come over to poker and you're like, whee, you know, gamble, gamble, you know, stuff like that. And so I just think that those lessons, if you learn them in poker, translate very well into investing. Right? Very well.
In times of, like, market chaos, like we're seeing right now, like, what are the things that you do to kind of control those emotions or control your psychology to make sure that you actually are thinking clearly and making sound decisions?
I try to come out of appreciation. Like, if you take everything away from me, like, I have my health, I'm able to love my kids. I have love and I give love. You know, and so I come from appreciation, like where I came from, where I've been, and what I have, no matter what you take away, right? I can at least breathe, right? So once I detach myself from the ego of you lost the money or you did this or what are people going to think, I can think clearly, right? I can start doing it now. It's like, okay, the market just dropped, I don't know, 30%. And I'm buying company X, Y, and Z, okay? So let's say I thought they were gonna pay me $10 a month for 30 years, but now these first 3 years are gonna be zero. what's the change in the MPV? Right. So that's a rational thought, right? Like, okay, we're not going to have, the company's going to survive. It's just not going to have revenues for the next 3 years, but it's going to survive. How did that change the MPV? And if the market's down 30 and the MPV should be down 17, I can rationally think that this is a bargain, right? I should be buying. And there were actually many, you know, we ran that exercise, right? It's a sledgehammer exercise, but we ran that exercise on a bunch of companies that were, we are not going bankrupt, right? May have impaired sales, right? Clearly, you know, and the market punished them, was an overreaction. And it's like, we're a buyer. And there were certain companies like, no, it's not going to survive. It may not survive. This is actually a sale, right? Without a bailout or a so-and-so, like it has debt due, it's over-levered, this thing should collapse, right? And that's a sale. And so being able to like remove what's happening to me, you know, and stay focused, outward focus on the problem is what I try and do, you know, and knowing that, hey, I'm really, really lucky. Like I live in the United States of America, high infrastructure, you know, even at my worst scenario where I'm waiting tables or something, like I'm okay. Right. And so once I remove that like panic about me and what's happened to me and what's happened to my money, then I can focus and start making right decisions.
Yeah. How do you think about like the dislocation right now in the market where it seems like stocks are, you know, relief rallying, if not really rallying, but the economic data we keep getting is going down, right? 26 million Americans unemployed, 4.8% contraction in Q1 for the economy. Like it just seems like the underlying data and the actual reality on the ground is way worse than the stock market, which seems to just be going in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think usually when you have scenarios like this where the government comes in and intervenes, it drives the wealth gap, right? And so I think like the current like rally, broadly speaking, is asset inflation, right? And so there is a massive effort to inflate the value of assets. And it's you just can't fight that, right? And so that's where you're gonna see this stock is up or doing X, Y, and Z or doing well or getting these funds while this guy is unemployed, et cetera, right? And so those who own stock X, Y, and Z do well or bought it at the dip, this guy still doesn't have a job, right? And so you see that divergence in unfortunately, in times like this with the government action, it usually drives the wealth gap. It doesn't help close it.
Yeah, it feels almost like it reiterates the point that the stock market's not the economy. It's just the central bank actions or representation.
Right. Of that.
How do you think about the bailouts and that government intervention, kind of the next step of that?
I'm generally, I'm not on the camp that the government should do nothing. But what the government is doing, I am generally 100% against. You know, there's a lot of companies that, you know, a lot of people have the idea, like, if this airline fails, then we won't have an airline. And that's just not true, right? When somebody goes bust with their house, the house doesn't disappear. Just a new owner shows up, right? That guy disappears. And so, you know, with the airlines, these owners that created this highly leveraged position, right, spent all their capital buying back their stock, didn't think about like, you know, the robustness or the stability, which is okay. I'm not even gonna mock that. It's okay if you wanna do that, but you have to accept the risk when something goes wrong in a leveraged scenario, you go bust. You don't get your executive bonus, you get fired, new management comes in, bondholders get smashed, they should have been paying attention, and the equity guys get wiped out. But the airlines are still there, and somebody will gladly come in, put in some capital, and run it, right? And so, what we've done is we've removed that, right? We removed that punishment, and I'm against it. I would much rather have all that money just be direct deposits into the individuals' pockets, right? Which actually helps close the wealth gap, and then let that money trickle up into whatever investments or whatever is out there, right? But now we're flowing money into concentrated pockets of businesses and industries, right? We're picking winners and losers. And letting them distribute the money as they see fit.
Yeah, it feels like what I know about you, I think that you're very much kind of the United States is the best country in the world, and we have a significant advantage around the American dream and kind of that belief that like we're all entitled to move up in the world. But it feels like when you start to take away the impact of risk taking, right, the actual negative side effects of when you take risk and it doesn't work your way, you change the incentive structure. Right, and it almost feels like you start to create this social safety net or corporate safety net that really almost incentivizes more bad behavior, more over leveraging if you know someone's going to bail you out every time.
Yeah, and it also like it hurts other guys and other competitors who don't get picked. Maybe I have Joe Upstart Airlines and I'm like, hey, the leverage ratio is pretty crazy and their customer service is shit. And you're building up your customers, right? I don't know what airline you are. Call it Spirit Clips. Not Spirit, because a lot of people hate Spirit. But you know what I mean? And you're like, great, this is my shot to take over. Like, I'm going to get those slots at Newark, and I'm going to get those slots at IAH, and my airline's going to grow. But here comes the government with $7.8 billion, or $72 billion, you know, into that airline, that airline, that airline. And you get squashed while they get rewarded, right? And so not only does the incentive structure change, it just solidifies incumbents, right, who probably shouldn't be there, right? And it crushes the American dream for a lot of people. A lot of people don't realize, like, there's people, organizations, entrepreneurs, upstarts, right, coming out to compete who are not getting the billions of dollars, right? And now it makes their job even harder, almost impossible in certain cases, right?
And you're almost in a situation where the government's playing kingmaker to some degree, right? That they're literally, you know, picking winners. And the other data point that I saw recently that just blew my mind was there's a lot of workers that are asking to be fired from various companies because they can make more on unemployment with the stimulus kind of beef up in the unemployment insurance than they will at their normal job. And it feels like that's just one, not something that I ever would have thought was possible. But two, it's kind of sad to see, right? Where people are literally saying, hey, fire me from my job because I literally can make more money on unemployment than you're paying me to actually show up here.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I'm a fan of like some sort of floor UBI, right? I'm at the point where I think that survival, just basic survival, should not be dependent on a job, right? All the land is taken. There's no living off the land and farming and all that kind of stuff. So you're kind of forced into the structure where if you want to survive and eat, you have to have a job, right? And I think a lot of people will culturally say, yeah, but of course. But it wasn't that way, right? That's not how America started. You did not have to go work for somebody, okay, in order to survive. Most people work for themselves, right? Went out in the West, settled, grew their crops, whatever. That is gone. You can't do that. And so there's this force element to work. Like, you must work or else you cannot survive, right? And I think that should be eliminated, right? And I'm not saying people should be lavish. I'm saying, like, at the poverty level, right, where you can survive. And I think that work should be for thriving. That being said, these levels of unemployment, you know, where I'm paying you, you know, I don't know if that's an indictment on unemployment or what they're paying the employees, but I think that's a little bit absurd.
Yeah. To me, I think that was the part that I took away from it, right? Was the fact that the wages that a lot of folks that are obviously asking to be fired, it has to be so low. Right. It's yeah. Not the, you know, $15 an hour type thing. You got to be talking about people who are probably making, you know, $8 to $10 an hour in today's environment. You know, it's sad, frankly. Right. But that's.
Yeah. And those are people that like, hey, I would rather work on my play or my theory of physics or whatever it is they could work on if their survival was taken care of. Right. If you knew you were going to survive. You know, I think that would unleash a lot of creativity and entrepreneurship out of the populace and not force them to work at McDonald's versus working on this brilliant cure for X, Y, and Z that's going to take 5 years, right? And so that's the crushing thing, like, people are missing about, like, having a floor and eliminating work from survival, is you actually unleash a ton of risk-taking and entrepreneurship, and you unlock the creativity of many people, right? There's so many people who are in soul-sucking, low-paying jobs just because they got to buy ramen noodles and beans. And if they had their ramen noodles and beans taken away, they would say F you to that job, right? And work on whatever they were working on, which I think society would benefit.
For sure. What's your thoughts on, like, all the quantitative easing and kind of the central bank's response to a lot of this, just in terms of, it seems like they could just print and print and print and there's no end in sight.
I am generally against it. Like I said, it favors rich guys like me, right? Guys who have assets and houses, you know, when you devalue money, you value assets, right? And, you know, I hear arguments like on Twitter, it's like, yeah, but it helps the poor because their debt is lower. I'm like, their wages don't go higher, okay? Their wages are not going higher, okay? And everything they buy is getting more expensive, right? And their debt is still the same. It hurts the poor 100%. The poor don't have $300,000 mortgages and $200,000 mortgages and inflation adjustments in their paycheck, right? Right. Nobody's getting the guaranteed CPI adjusted wage. Right. And so it's just terrible, you know, and I think, like, if it ever gets to the situation where the world goes violent over the wealth gap, I'm going to be like, don't blame me. I was against all this inflationary crap that hurts the poor. Right. I just think it's terrible. It's just plain terrible.
Yeah. And part of, you know, what last year or so, I've really kind of pounded the drum on that I think is so interesting is, like, every single person that has any degree of wealth that I talk with or any amount of assets, they all understand this, right? And what's very quickly become obvious to me is there's this big education gap as well, right? Because the bottom 50% or so of Americans who can't afford the $400 emergency payment or whatever, you know, whatever the latest stats are, they actually don't understand how money works. They don't understand that all that quantitative easing is stealing the wealth, devaluing their savings and things like that. It's the people who have the assets, they get it, right? And whether they agree with it or not, they understand how the game works. And so they're going to position themselves to be protected, to benefit, et cetera. And it almost feels like the system is dependent on a big portion of people not understanding how it works to some degree.
Oh yeah, there's a couple of good quotes. I forget who said it, but if people knew how their money worked, they would, you know what I mean? They'd kill the king, right? They'd kill. I am actually shocked at how financially illiterate the public generally is, right? If I say net present value, and people are like, what the fuck are you talking about, net present value? You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, simple things. Like, it's not like they don't have the math skills. They do, because, you know, you had to learn these things. It's just that this is not taught. It doesn't seem to be a priority. And it's so important to, like, even just your daily life. Like, should I have money in this bank account, in my savings account, while I have credit card debt? Like, this is a very simple thing, right? Like, you don't carry 24%, you know, you don't pay, you know what I mean, to have cash in the bank. You can use your credit card for anything. You want another cash withdrawal, you can take it out at any time. But there are so many people, friends of mine, that I'm just like, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? You're paying to have money in the bank. They don't get it. And so, I don't know. It's just sad. It's sad. Like, I think a lot of my discussions, like, people are, you know, I get into, like, these Twitter battles. I love Twitter. I'm addicted to Twitter. And people are like, why are you arguing with this troll? Like, why are you doing X, Y, and Z? And the reason is that there are other people reading that discussion, and I want them to learn. I want them to know, right? And so as long as we can have a civil conversation, I can hopefully help somebody else to go either investigate further or learn about what's going on and dispel the myths that are getting thrown around.
For sure. You live a fun life. Talk a little bit about kind of the lifestyle stuff and kind of how you've structured your life to enjoy it now, rather than, you know, kind of working every single day inside of a normal office?
Yeah, like, you know, the great thing about technology is that, you know, people talk about remote work, and I've been remote for a while, right? And so everything from the applications we build in-house to other trading applications I have on my phone. So the good thing is that I can be anywhere and work from anywhere. The bad thing is I can be anywhere and work from anywhere, right? So it's a double-edged sword. But, you know, my favorite thing in the world to do is travel. So there's a kibosh on that right now. And, you know, I spend most of my time trying to change what my office looks like, right? I'll go to Tokyo or go to St. Petersburg or go to Europe. You know, that's kind of all on hold right now. And so I'm in the Virgin Islands where, you know, at least I can be on the water, you know, and, you know, I'm out here with all the other boats. I give you a little look, you know, I'm hanging out here. If you can see that, do you see that? Yeah,
of course.
I just kind of go where I like and just try and be at peace. And the water and the animals and sea life, I'm at peace here.
For sure. And then you've got this kind of idea. I know you got a book coming out over the summer, but Die with Zero, right? Maybe kind of explain what that concept really means and kind of how you put it into practice.
Well, so independently, I've been thinking about like the utility of money and what it's for, right? You spend hours of your life in exchange for money in order to do things, to have experiences. The first experience is survival, right? You want to survive. You want to feed yourself, shelter, health, whatever. And then the other is other experiences that you want to have, whether that's putting your kids to college or going on a trip or buying baseball cards or going to a show, right? We're all working in order to exchanging hours of life in order to have other experiences. Okay. And so it stands to reason that if I go to work to acquire money, to have experiences, but then die, I just wasted hours of my life, right? Like why did I go to work for money that I'm never going to use? And so, you know, it quickly said in my head that you want to use all your resources before you die. And I'm not the first person to think about this. Economists call it full life cycle hypothesis or full life cycle theory. Basically, rational people will aim to die with zero, okay? And then the other part of it that I stuck into it that I was thinking about is that, you know, as I've seen people in my life, my dad, my grandmother, and other people age, right? And then when you look at the data, your ability to extract positive life experiences, you know, have experiences, declines as you age. I can tell people the memory of playing football right now is greater than actually playing football right now for me, right? And so that will happen with all experiences, including sex. Like you'll be at a certain age, be like, wow, that was a great time back in my 30s. But trying to have sex then might be like, I don't want to break a hip. I don't want to, you know what I mean? Like whatever it is. And so not only is there, hey, you should aim to spend all your money before you die, you have to get the timing right? You know, you don't want to go hella skiing at 90. You probably want to go hella skiing between, you know, 30 and 50, right? And I'm just using extreme examples, right? And there's always outliers, so I don't want to get into that. But I'm just saying on the whole, right, there's a season for you to do different activities. And making sure that you allocate your resources properly within each season is important. You know, and I've been saying it a lot lately. I said, life is like Tetris, right? You got to get the order right in order to get the most points, right? In order to get the fullest life. So anybody who's like, hey, I'm going to wait till I'm 90 to go hike Kilimanjaro and then go to St. Petersburg and do whatever, they got it wrong, right? That money was meant to be spent now. And a lot of people actually do that. And what happens is what you see is those who save too much. People's net worth keep growing into their 70s and 80s. And it's like, what are they waiting for? Right? Yeah.
For sure. In that sense, I think you recently turned 50 years old, right? And, what's left on kind of your bucket list or what are the things that you say, hey, you know, these are the things that I want to do in the next 10 years?
Right. So I try and break them up in categories. And I actually have a beta version one of like bucket your life because each time bucket matters. You know, one of the things is like, as writing this book and thinking about it, like, holy shit, I need to listen to the same things I'm talking about, right? Like not be the fat coach on the sidelines. Like, You know what I mean? Like, it was all out of shape, you know, but it's the coach. That was me, right? And so I'm like, wait a minute. I got to spend time with my daughters. These are the activities I want to do, et cetera. These are the places I want to travel, things I want to investigate, projects I want to work on, charities I want to help or problems I want to solve. You know, I've kind of put them into those buckets. And so travel was way number one for me, which is really, you know, nobody's going to play the violin for me. I'm super lucky, but I'm like, ah, you know what I mean? Like, not being able to travel is a crusher. So now I'm like refocusing on personal relationships, helping people and charities and helping solving problems, you know, research projects and just learning, you know, and loving and keeping in contact with my personal relationships. So it's been a great quiet time to actually do that with family and be forced to be stuck in a house, you know, and being with two teenage girls in a house, it's not easy, but every day I'm like, this is great. You know, yeah, we had a blowout battle, screaming and yelling and then crying and then yelling and then whatever. But like, this is great. Like, I'm going to look back one day and be like, this was the best of times. And so I'm just learning to live in gratitude right now. And then I'm planning when this opens up to really, really travel, like really burn it and travel and, you know, learn other cultures and go to places I haven't been and visit some places that are high on my list that that I love.
Have your daughters got you on TikTok yet? Have they pulled in any of the dance videos?
I mean, they're on TikTok. They're doing dance videos. They do not want me on it. I used to be a cool dad to them, but now like it embarrasses them. They're like, all my friends follow you on Instagram. I can't stand it. They're always saying something, you know, teenagers are like anything I do wrong or that's like not cool or my girlfriend's boobs are showing or whatever, they're like, ah, you know, your dad's girlfriend, ah, you know, whatever it is, right? And so they hate it. They hate it. They hate that there's a book coming out and I might be more recognizable. It's just, it annoys them.
Well, the worst part is probably all the girls probably say stuff that are their age, and then the guys all probably love you, right? They're like, oh, I want to do that stuff.
Yeah, they don't like it. Like, they have, you know, I thought like a lot of their guy friends, they like kind of want to meet me or say hi or whatever. At that very instant, I'm cool. They like it, but it still annoys them. They're like, no, don't come because everybody's going to want to talk to you. And they want it to be about them. They feel as if I'm ruining their high school experience, you know, and I don't want to ruin their high school experience. You know, it's kind of weird, you know, but it's the way it is, you know.
Look, we all been in high school, and pretty much anything can ruin it, right? Like, literally anything could throw it off.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm trying not to ruin it. I'm trying to protect them, raise them well, whatever. Probably doing it, like, 70% wrong, but I'm there. You know what I mean? Like, I'm there.
Absolutely. That's half the battle. All right, man. Listen, where do you want people to go in terms of sending them to either check out the book when it comes out or find out more about what you guys do on the investing side?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if our website's been updated for smallventuresusa.com for investing, you know, but that's where, you know, a lot of people are like, who do I talk to? I'm like, you know, if they follow the links or whatever, you'll get to the right person to get the deal through. And then diewithzerobook.com for the book. But unfortunately, or fortunately maybe, because bookstores are closed right now, and that's a significant portion of book sales, even though you know, the online isn't making up for the book, you know, the amount that's gone from physical sales. But July 28th, it's coming out and you can pre-order, and I appreciate it, you know, and I think you will appreciate it too, because a lot of people are spending a lot of money, you know, whether it's the state, your insurance, or yourself, to extend your life for 3 months in a hospital bed with a low quality of life. And I'm like, you know, that's kind of backwards. Take all that money, put it in the good health years, create memories, have those memory dividends with people, and really live a full life, and fuck the 3 months in the hospital bed.
I don't remember where I heard this, but I adopted it as a life motto years ago, was anything worth doing is worth overdoing. And if you think through everything that you do in your life, if it's worth doing it, it's absolutely worth overdoing it to some degree.
Yeah, and I think like living your life to the fullest is definitely one of the things you want to do while you have your health, you know.
For sure. I wrap up each conversation with two questions for you, and then you get to ask me one. The first is, what is the most important book you've ever read?
Wow. I'm going to tie it with two. The Four Agreements is probably edging out Your Money or Your Life. So one is a financial book and one is like holistic approach about life. So The Four Agreements is number one. That's my number one recommended book. And Your Money or Your Life, which kind of started the FIRE movement, financial independence to retire early. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that book completely changed the way I look at money and personally and also professionally. Right. And led to further discoveries and questions, et cetera. Right. And so, and it's why I went into trading. It's my understanding of leverage, of not leverage just of money, but leverage of time. Right. When somebody makes a lot of money, all he's doing is like, his time is leverage. 1 minute of my time is like 1 hour of that guy's time. Right. And we're just exchanging time. And so, that understanding, that concept, and how money works allows me to, really change my life. And the Four Agreements is just like really changed my life.
Have you ever seen the movie In Time with Justin Timberlake?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It could have been better. I love the concept though.
So that's basically it, right? It's like the concept was spot on, but the acting was, it was all right.
Yeah, they could have done the story better or whatever, but the concept was brilliant. It was great. I was really looking forward to it. And, Your Money or Your Life, it's a little didactic because it's really trying to hammer in the point and change when you're trying to change people's cultural views and what they've already or, what they've accepted via osmosis and everything around them. You have to be didactic. You have to be repetitive because they won't get it. So, but still, that book is a must read.
Awesome. Aliens, believer or non-believer in some sort of intelligent life out there?
I think the answer is believer, but we'll never know. So, if something's, a billion light years away, you're not going to know, right? Even if it's 500 light years away, you're just never going to know, right? Yes, I have this kind of almost religious belief that it just, the numbers just are so large that it must be. But the idea that we're going to get in contact or capture a signal, even if they were sending signals, it's like, very, 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 very unlikely you're going to grab them or get them, et cetera. So I don't know. I guess that's an unsatisfying answer.
Yeah, it's good. I actually almost forgot to ask you thoughts on Bitcoin. That was another one that everyone wants to know. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin?
I'm kind of ambivalent. I'm actually long it proxy because I'm long this company. I bought the stock, very teeny company called Silvergate Partners or Silvergate Capital, SI, on the New York Stock Exchange. They actually had good results today, a release.
Silvergate Bank, is that what it is?
Yeah, that's the one, SI, symbol is SI. And they basically have a platform where they're one of the niche players where they provide lending to institutions, trading Bitcoin, clearing, and they're now starting this product to offer them some leverage because they need to have both Bitcoin and cash on every exchange that they trade. And so, banks are all about capital efficiency, so the leverage product may work. And so I'm like, I'd rather be long the shovel maker than the gold miner. You know what I mean? Like, I think Bitcoin can, I was once long it, went up to 17,000, and then I ran some calculations, and I was like, well, it'd be impossible to redo the blockchain, right? And then I did some calculations, and I was like, well, if you bought this amount of money, right, if you spent this amount of money on servers, you could rehash the block, right, at this value, right, in this time. And that just kind of gave me a sense of this thing is overvalued when it was 17,000, right? And, it's an adoption phenomenon. It's a marketing thing. Will people keep and believe in Bitcoin, and will it grow? And I really don't know. You know, I hear arguments for yes, I hear arguments for no. But in the meanwhile, I'm like, well, this is a bank. These guys are trading it. It's not going to get hurt. It's very conservative. It's making revenues off of Bitcoin. You know, not by, you know, if the price goes up, that means more people are trading. They'll make more money. If it's volatile, goes up and down, they make more money because people are trading it in a fee-based business. I'd rather be on that side and be long it. So I'm quasi-long Bitcoin. You know?
Yeah. Look, and especially if it's a, hey, I don't know, it's actually a pretty, pretty rational position to take. Alan, the CEO of Silvergate's been on the podcast and, is, you know, credit to him. I think back in like 2013 or 14, he really saw the opportunity and kind of moved that entire bank into let's be the player here. Cause the large banks won't be. And it's proved to be a pretty good decision for them, obviously.
Yeah, it's great. And it's like, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's Beanie Babies, right? Like, it's like, I don't care where Beanie Babies are going. I'm still making money servicing the Beanie Baby crowd, right? Until it goes away or, you know, it stays around. And so I like what he's done. He's visionary. Maybe he's a believer in the price will go up and that'll be great for his business. But they are a niche player where other people just don't want to deal with all the KYC and the bullshit and they don't want to get involved into it, right? And so I think it's great.
Yeah, it makes sense. What one question do you have for me to finish this up?
Why did you get into podcasting and do you still like it?
I've told the story on the podcast before, but I had some kids come to me who basically were like, hey, you should do a podcast. And I'd listened to a couple of podcasts, but knew nothing that went into it. Literally was like, my mom always said, you know, I had the face for radio, giving me a hard time, but why the hell would I do this? And we recorded a couple of episodes and released it. And it was immediately people started listening. I was like, wait a second, you're telling me that I can go sit in a room, talk to somebody, just have a microphone there and hit publish. And like everyone else gets excited. And I don't have to like sit and write and then like edit, you know, my writing and like all of the work that goes into publishing, like much more kind of higher production stuff, especially when you're writing. And so for whatever reason, I was just like, well, let's do another one. And here we are. I think we've done like over 280 of them in about a year and a half or so. And I enjoy it because it's two things for me. And I always say like, it's very selfish, right? So first is you and I probably wouldn't talk unless I had the podcast. So there's right. This element of like, I get to meet a lot of people who are kind of tangentially related to what I do. And obviously I learn from them. I get to ask them questions and all of that. So that's super valuable to me. And then the second thing is, as I've started to do this, I just began to realize like you could go on CNBC and all of the ideas you have in your head, they may give you 5 minutes, right? And that would be like a long segment, or they might give you two. Right. And it's not, you know, to pick on CNBC specifically, it's just all of those kind of television formats. They're very hitch driven around kind of salacious comments. It's very, you know, cutting up a lot of different segments. And so you just don't have a lot of time to explain your ideas. And I think these kind of longer form podcasts really allow people to share their ideas in their words without being interrupted and explain what they mean, right? It's one thing for you to say, hey, you know, I think that the money printing is not a good situation. Okay, well, what does that mean? And when you explain it, you get the context and it ends up being much more valuable content, I think, for people who really are just trying to learn. So I enjoy it and I'll keep doing it until one day I wake up and it's not fun. And then I'll just be like, all right, guys, that was a good run. See ya.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's great. And I totally agree with you. Like I've been on CNBC before and it's just like, what blurb headline thing can you get out? And you when you don't explain and give context, like, you know, people twist it, right? Like I'm against the money printing. Oh, he's against helping Americans. You know, no. You know what I mean? So yeah, I get it. And I appreciate you and the other podcasters for doing this, getting out there. It's super entrepreneurial and it's awesome.
For sure. So we will, we'll send people over to go check out the book and I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah. Anytime. Hope everybody got value out of it.